Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm your host, journalist Holly Rubenstein, and here each week I'll be speaking to a very special guest about the seven chapters in their life's travel diaries. From their earliest childhood travel memory and the first place they fell in love with, to their hidden gem and what's at the top of their travel bucket list. We'll be uncovering their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. Well, I hope everyone is having a good start to the week. It feels as though autumn has finally arrived here in London. I'm just back from a week in Puglia, a much more balmy week, I should say, in the south of Italy, which I totally fell in love with. Puglia is a region that has become so popular of late. I know so many people who have traveled there in the last couple of years. Most have loved it. A few people have said that they weren't so keen. I think that might depend on where you stay. It's quite a big region. So when you're looking at the different places to book, make sure that you stay in an area that is near the coast, not too far from all the big sites, because otherwise you'll have a lot of realistically driving around to do. But Puglia surprised me in so many ways. We stayed near to Savelletri, which was a perfect location, just a few minutes from the sea. Big hills, nearly mountains behind you, which I didn't expect because I thought Puglia was very flat. And I was just amazed at how green it was. Palm trees, olive groves, green grass, bright flora everywhere. And I was blown away by the hospitality, as you would expect from Italy. They were obsessed with Isabella. We could barely move at breakfast for people stopping to say hi to her. She got so much attention. Still didn't learn to say ciao by the end of the trip, which I was slightly disappointed about, but she had a wonderful time. I stayed in a couple of truly knock your socks off hotels, which for hotel lovers, I hope you'll be interested to hear about. One that I'm going to be reviewing on here. It will be in my forthcoming family travel episode, Borgo Ignazia. I'll tell you more about that on that episode. And then the other was a spot called Masseria Torre Maizza, which was actually picked by my guest from last season, Alex Palizzi. It's part of her family's Rocco Forte hotel collection. And so after we spoke, I managed to sneakily get in a few nights stay there, and it was a very special place. I would say that there were a lot of people there who were on their honeymoon, and because it's that kind of masseria feel, there are so many masserias around that part of Puglia. They're small homesteads, 10, 20, 30 rooms, very boutique and feel, very intimate, but the attention to detail there was very, very special. And Borgo Ignazia, wow, it blew me away. You might have seen it on the amazing Hotels Life Beyond the Lobby series on the BBC at the moment. It was on just a few weeks ago. I need to watch the episode. I didn't want to watch it because I didn't want to spoil the surprise of visiting it, but I can't wait to share more about it. Needless to say, it was a place that was perfect for children. And I will tell you more about the region and my experience in a little bit more detail next week, as my guest, coming up next week, coincidentally has just made a TV show all about the region. So that was perfect, and we had a little deep dive into our recommendations. Okay, on to today's guest. This is an exciting one. The Queen of British Soul, a West End superstar and Olivier Award winner. If you've ever swayed to the rhythms of Beverly Knight's songs like Shoulda Woulda Coulda, Come As You Are, you know that Beverly's voice has the power to transport you to another world. But what about the destinations that have transported her? She's a seasoned traveler with a passport filled to the brim with stamps from all over the world. And today she's going to take us on a journey through her most meaningful travel experiences, from New York to Brazil, Jamaica to the Bahamas, with such clear passion for travel. She's got stories that will make your wanderlust soar. So get ready to join us as we explore the world through the eyes and the incredible voice of the one and only Beverly Knight. Beverly Knight, welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. so lovely to see you. How are you?
I am well, Holly. How are you?
I'm great. The sun is kind of flooding into the room that I'm recording in, which is a bit of a novelty us here in the UK. So it's that kind of back to school feeling at the moment, I feel like, in the air. Can you sense it?
It's that autumnal. It's just creeping in a little bit, but it's still sunny.
So yeah, we're lucky we've had this Indian summer, haven't we, really?
Yeah, yeah. And we seem to be getting that a lot more now.
Have you been traveling much this summer? Where have you last come back from?
So I have been doing a bit of traveling. I've literally just got back from Turkey.
Ah, welcome back.
Thank you very much. I was at the Datça Peninsula in a lovely hotel down there. It's like a big resort. And I was celebrating my friend's daughter's 30th. And so he's a lovely guy. He's a generous guy. It's Ron Dennis, who used to own McLaren.
Oh, wow.
He's a good friend of mine and my husband. So yeah. He flew a bunch of us over to celebrate his daughter's 30th. And it was fun. It was interesting.
I've not been to that part of Turkey. Like, what's it like? I know that it's incredibly beautiful.
It's funny because in my mind, if you say Turkey to me, I think of Istanbul. People, busy, traffic, can't move, stunning architecture, you know, the Bosphorus. And that's my abiding image. But I know that's not the whole story because Turkey is a huge country. The Datça Peninsula, mountains, and the Aegean Sea, and greenery. I mean, it's so green.
Really? So it's lush.
It's a lush, green, mountainous area with water everywhere. Obviously, it's a peninsula. And quiet and calm and peaceful and utterly beautiful. Utterly beautiful. It was spellbinding, actually. I loved every second of it.
And were you spending your time in the water, like out on boats, like swimming? How do you love to spend your time when you're away?
I was in that water every day at every opportunity. Yeah. I spent the entire time on the beach. I am that person who, if I'm going on holiday, I need the beach and the water. I need that access. Mm. Otherwise, it doesn't feel like a proper holiday. It almost feels like, okay, I'm probably going to end up working any minute now, you know, someone's going to hand me a microphone and I'm going to work. If I'm in like a city holiday, for example.
Yeah.
But when I'm at a beach and the water's there, made even more beautiful with the mountains around me, that's when I know, Bev, you're on holiday. You can relax. You can let go.
That's so nice. You've sold me on that. I'm going to add that to my travel list because that just sounds stunning. So
really,
I'm really,
really
glad
gorgeous.
That you had a lovely time because now life's getting busy again.
It is. It really is.
This exciting new chapter with your new album and your tour, which we'll come on to. But actually, first, we're going right back to the very beginning because, Beverly, we're going on a journey through the 7 chapters of your life's travel diaries today. And
indeed.
We start at the very beginning of your life, chapter 1, and that is your earliest childhood travel memory.
Oh, well, that's an easy one. I was lucky enough to travel a lot as a child around the UK, but I remember in 1983 when I was 10, yes, I'm that old, my mum said, Bev, we're going on a big adventure because you're going to be bridesmaid at my friend's wedding. And I was like, oh, bridesmaid. I was so excited for the dress and everything.
Mm-hmm.
She said, we're going to New York. And I was like, now, I've got to set the scene. I'm 10 years of age. It's all about the dress, but on TV at that time was Fame and Hill Street Blues.
Yes.
You know, and these are things that were set in New York City. And that was where I was going. Oh, my God.
The excitement.
The excitement. I was going to the home of Knight Rider, the New York High School of Performance Arts, and we had friends who lived right near, you know, the Bronx, Hill Street Blues. I was going to see it all. Cool. And so for me, going to New York, I flew on TWA, which doesn't even exist anymore. There was a smoking section at the front. You know, definitely doesn't exist anymore. I had the absolute thrill of going to the cockpit so I could look. I mean, these things just don't happen. Looking around at all these switches and buttons and things and looking out the window and looking at the clouds below me. I'd never seen anything like this. It was the first time I'd been on a plane.
How exciting.
The excitement was in overdrive. But then arriving at New York, at JFK Airport, and the chaos and the madness and everybody shouting and, you know, and then the journey into NYC itself. Oh, my God. I mean, I'd never seen anything like it. Yellow cabs everywhere. People everywhere. Skyscrapers. You know, the accent, which, of course, I was already well-versed in performance by then. So the first thing I did was try and get the very specific New York accent.
Copy the New York, New York.
The New York with the New heavy York. Tongue, you know. So I was...
absolutely nailed it right there.
This place blew me away. And because Knight Rider was in its absolute zenith, of course, for me, in my 10-year-old imagination, every third car I saw was a Pontiac Trans Am. It wasn't. It absolutely wasn't. But there were, you know, black Pontiac Trans Ams everywhere. And, you know, and then I was like, oh my God, look, there's Knight Rider. Mum, Knight Rider's over there. There's another Knight Rider. I mean, I was mesmerized by this place, you know. And we actually, we went to visit my uncle. I've got loads of family who live in New York. And my uncle could see my excitement. So he took us on a sightseeing tour. He had an old Lincoln Town car.
Mm-hmm. And then
big, wide car. And so we're off and we're looking out the window. And he said, you're a performer, aren't you? And I said, yes, uncle. Because this was the first time I was actually meeting my uncle as well. This was a lot of my family I'd never seen. We only spoke long distance on the phone. Remember those old dial-up phones?
Yeah. So it was so meaningful in many ways because you're also connecting with family.
That's right. So I was meeting a whole bunch of family I didn't know. We were in the back of his Lincoln Town car. And we're traveling. And then we arrived at the New York High School of Performance Arts, the building that it's based on, that fame was based on. I couldn't even speak. I was so knocked out that I was seeing the home of Leroy and Bruno and, oh my God, and Laurie and, oh, it just thrilling. We drove through the Bronx, and I saw a police car. I've got a picture somewhere of me with a policeman looking pleased as punch, you know, and Hill Street Blues came flooding back. It was incredible. The Statue of Liberty. And then the thing that really, I haven't even talked about the wedding, because to me, the wedding was secondary at this point, even though I was initially excited about the dress. Yeah. But the thing that really crowned New York City for me was standing on top of the roof of the South Tower of, the Twin Towers. One of my most treasured memories now is that picture of me, my mum's friend's father, and my cousin with just the blue sky behind us on the roof of the World Trade Center, the South Tower. Who knew what was going to happen all those years later? But I still have those incredible memories. And I've got goosebumps thinking about the whole trip. Absolutely incredible.
And so when you then landed back in England,
yeah,
did that energy, that excitement that you experienced seeing like the fame building, you know, did that spur you on in your, you know, your passion for singing and your passion for performance?
That visit crystallized everything for me.
Really?
About where my life and my career was going to go.
Oh, that gives me shivers.
Honest to God.
Mm.
10 years of age, I had no idea how I was going to get there, but I knew I was going to make it. Even at that early age, because the world was not as big and as terrifying and as remote, you know, that the idea that I could sing and dance and act, well, not so much the dancing, but sing and act in my adult years, I it didn't seem so far away. The dream wasn't somewhere over there that I was never, ever going to reach, because yeah. I'd seen it, I touched it, I'd been there. And I knew I could do it. And I held on to that my entire life until, and it only took, you know, 11 years later, I signed my first recording contract.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not a long time.
No. So I mean, in terms of that journey from that moment to signing, you know, what was, in a nutshell, like, what was the trajectory? Because it did happen quickly.
It did. I went to school full of New York. Everything was New York and fame and everything. And through my childhood years and through my teenage years, going to school, having the Wolverhampton Youth Theatre right there that I could do productions every summer. You know, again, the dream was coming closer. It's coming closer. I was doing lots of performances and productions at school. So I spent all my time, in my opinion, honing myself for this career that I was surely going to have. And also at church. You know, I had a church background. So I was singing and performing with the choir, with the church band, you know, just perfecting everything.
Such a good opportunity to hone your performance in a church setting as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. And in an evangelical, you know, Pentecostal church, which lots of people will affectionately call a gospel type church, it was music all the way, clapping, singing, you know, drums, keys, bass, guitar, choir. We were amplified, you know, it was a gig every Sunday.
Yeah.
So I got to perfect every aspect and every facet of performance, kind of in a informal context in church, in a more formal context with the Wolverhampton Youth Theatre and my school. And all of that crystallized and came together when, aged about 19, I was singing in a club in Wolverhampton. It was the birthday party of a community radio station, and me being the local talent, I was asked to go and perform, and they'd got a big, you know, artist to be the headline act. He was having a hits at the time, you know, R&B, soul music. His A&R saw me perform. He traveled with him,
right.
And that was how I got my deal. Wow. He saw me. He said, I want to talk to you about perhaps signing with, you know, my record label who I represent. That was Dome Records. I said to him, I think I'm really good, but if you think I'm really good, you'll wait for me to finish my degree.
Wow.
Can't believe those
words
came out.
That is very sensible.
Sensible, but like, oh my God. I mean, he could have walked away and gone, she's not serious.
Yeah.
But
was that your parents? Had they instilled that in you? Like, I need to get my education under my belt.
Absolutely. And I was really bookish. I still am. I'm still quite let's be honest, I'm still a nerd at heart. I love study. I love books.
The coolest nerd that I've met.
Coolest nerd. Come on, singing nerd. But I wanted to stay on and do my you know, finish my education. Well, up to that point, you know, get my degree. Mm. And my mum and dad were absolutely, you know, you will finish your degree. So I said, you'll wait for me. They waited. And I signed in the final year of my degree.
Good for you. What an amazing story.
Yeah.
And the rest was history.
And the rest is history.
Let's pause there, Beverly, and just move on to chapter two. That yes. is the first place you fell in love with. I mean, clearly you fell in love with New York, that's for sure.
There is no two ways about it. New York to this day has my absolute heart. I love that place. Mm. Love it.
And do you go back a lot still?
Yes, every opportunity. Honestly, I go there and I feel, I don't know, I feel like the all-conquering hero. I feel as though this is the place where dreams happen. This is the place where you can do anything you want. You can be whoever you want to be and no one's going to look at you and go, oh, look at that weirdo walking down the street. Everybody's a weirdo in New York.
Yeah, it's so true. It's so true. And when you go, and so when you go there now as grown up Beverly rather than little yes. Beverly, what are the things that you always do? Are there some, do you have some spots that you just love to go back to?
Yes. So there's a place in Midtown, a place called Tea and Sympathy. It's a British spot. She comes all the way to New York to go and eat Welsh rarebit and spotted dick. But because it's in the middle of New York and it's so unexpected, I have to go. You know, yeah. if I want a proper decent cup of tea, you're not going to get a decent cup of tea anywhere in New York unless you go to Tea and Sympathy. It's run by two lovely Brits. So it's the real deal. It's not New Yorkers trying to do something here. It's actual Brits. And they run the place and it's gorgeous. You can get everything you want. So if you just want a bit of home for 5 minutes, you know, go to Tea and Sympathy. It's great. But outside of there, if you want the real kind of Harlem experience, you got to head north. If you're in Midtown, you got to head north. Get on that A train, mm-hmm. Or drive up Amsterdam, and eventually the other side of Central Park, you'll get into the world famous Harlem. It is not dodgy and dangerous like people always said it was. It's frankly, it's quite gentrified now, but there is a spot on 126th called Sylvia's, and it does soul food, mm-hmm. But New York style. So if you want that African-American eating experience, go to Sylvia's, but go on a Sunday where they do a gospel brunch and you can sit around and eat, you know, your collard greens and your smothered chicken and, you know, all that good stuff, your macaroni cheese, pumpkin pie, and you will have a bunch of singers come out and sing gospel music while you eat.
That is a perfect Sunday. Perfect Sunday.
It really is. And it's only a little hop, skip and a jump across the road from the Apollo, the famous Apollo Theatre, where just about everyone who is anyone has performed, especially in the area of, you know, the black music American experience. Absolutely everybody's been there. Absolutely everybody's played there. It's glorious. Absolutely glorious.
Brilliant recommendation. And I mean, you know, as such a veteran of the stage, is there a production that you would say that you've experienced in New York on Broadway that if we were traveling to New York that we just have to see, we have to get tickets for?
Let me tell you, I first saw The Lion King on Broadway. That was the first time I saw it. Before I saw it at home at the Lyceum, I saw it on Broadway. And I was with all my family. Maybe it's because I was with all my family. But I won't give too much away for people who haven't seen The Lion King. But the opening number will floor you and will bring you to tears. It's the most moving opening I have ever seen in theatre.
Yeah.
In my life. You know what I'm talking about.
I do. I'm picturing there was a clip that went viral after the COVID lockdown when the UK cast came back together and they sung that opening number in a rehearsal space. Yeah. And like everyone was in tears. It went viral. Yeah. I shared it on all of my social platforms.
I saw it.
And it was just, it's just the most rousing, powerful piece of music. And the also like it's raw.
It's so raw. Goosebumps. Oh, my God. Again. Second time. It's so incredible. I was in tears. I was in tears. Absolute tears. One number in and I was in tears. And, you know, the audience, this is New York. The audiences are very demonstrative.
Yeah, that singing.
They were moving. Absolutely in it. And the place erupted after that one number. People were like, hell yeah, yeah. You know, it was just amazing. I would, if you've never been to a theatre in your life ever, and you want to go, you've got a trip to New York, if there's only one thing you see, get a ticket, see The Lion King. You'll never look back. You'll go to theatre because you'll want to experience that feeling over and over again.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. And what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb. So chapter 3, Beverly, is the place where you learned the most about yourself.
Yeah. Now, this place is a remarkable and special place. You might expect me to talk about home, you know, in terms of my roots and my heritage, but actually I really learned who I was when I went to Salvador in the Bahia region of Brazil. I went there with mum. It was a charity trip. I went there with Christian Aid, and it was in my capacity as a HIV AIDS awareness ambassador. So I was going there to see how the HIV and AIDS crisis had affected that particular part of the world, because at the time South America was being decimated by the scourge of the HIV virus and AIDS.
And you lost a close friend also, didn't you?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right. Now, he was still alive. Tyrone was still with us when I went to Salvador, but I just wanted to learn. I wanted to steep myself in the experiences of people who didn't have the same resources as us and didn't have the same kind of clinic on every turn, you know. And a country which really, really was in trouble and had a government who frankly didn't care. So I went there, and it profoundly shook me to my core. Some of the things I saw, the people were warm and welcoming and beautiful, but what it was doing to their communities, particularly Afro-Brazilians, who in terms of their heritage are cousins, if you like, to people like me who are Jamaican origin. You know, right. We have the same exact history. It's just, to be frank, the slave ship went to there, you know, to Salvador, and another slave ship went to Jamaica, you know. But we had so much in common, down to the food, everything. And the experiences of what those people went through just really taught me about how much I have.
Gratitude.
And how much I have to be grateful for. Absolutely. Gratitude, Holly. But for the grace of God, you know, I could have been born in one of those favelas in abject poverty, the likes of which I've never seen either before or since.
Really?
Poverty has a very unique smell. When I went to visit a community in a place called Lobato, which was a very specific favela out there in Salvador, it was built over sewers.
Gosh.
The smell hit me. I've never smelled anything like it.
I can imagine.
The people who were there seemed to be, understandably, completely immune. It was their community. They built a life for themselves. If you imagine those kind of houses that are built on stilts, this is how a lot of the houses were, because obviously it was literally over sewers. So you had to access it up on stairs and, you know, people's houses. And they invited me in and sat and talked to me about their fight for HIV. And it was the women who led the fight. They were out there fighting for their primarily sons and daughters, taking the government head on, you know, challenging them. What were you going to do for our children? And then also the social aspect of it, not just the HIV and AIDS fight, but because these people were seen as the lowest of the low and getting in the way of tourism, they were hidden away. They were persecuted in some cases, in certain cases, you know, brutally, fatally even. Honestly, that was an eye-opener of a trip. And that made me think to myself, my God, Bev, you have no grounds to complain about anything. You literally, the phrase first world problems was just brought to the forefront of my life in that trip. I absolutely love that place, so much so that I wrote a song called Salvador on one of my albums,
because it just affected you so much.
So much and so deeply. It was a blessing of a trip.
And so from the start of your career, you've been championed by some of the industry's all-time legends, David Bowie, Prince. Prince in particular, I thought, just must have been so, I mean, I'm telling you how I think you feel, but I mean, how amazing, given that I know that you've spoken about how you listened to him growing up and how you, you know, how he shaped a lot of your love of music. So then to find out that he was a fan of yours, like how did that work? How did that feel?
Oh, God. Prince is, anybody who knows anything about me, you know, knows that I am a Prince obsessive and have been my whole life. You know, that Prince is all over the walls of my house. And I mean, my poor husband, he just has to just deal with it.
Shay. But,
exactly. Exactly. I always tell people, you know, Prince was my first husband and then I married James. I first met Prince in 1999. It's he was over here promoting an EP that he was doing, and I met him at the Mermaid Theatre. I was invited to see him do a showcase, and then after the show I was taken round to very briefly just meet him, shake his hand, and my life was made. I've met Prince. I could die tomorrow. I was happy. But the story didn't end there. I saw him very briefly again just later on that year, because he was performing on the same TV show as I was,
right.
A show called The Millennium Tube, which was celebrating artists and everything of the millennium. And so, though, you know, Paul McCartney was there. Of course, Prince was there. Nina Simone was there. Like...
the
so
ultimate all-star
people.
Lineup.
It
basically.
Really
yeah.
was. It really yeah. was. And it was that there was a Talking Heads panel and everybody was performing. And it was just a celebration of just how far the human race had come in the past, you know, 1,000 years, and specifically focusing on pop music and the explosion of rock and roll to that day. So Prince was there. And I was aware that he had my album. This is my second album at the time, because the runners were coming up to me saying, Prince has got your album and he's playing it in the dressing room. And I was like, oh my God, he knows. He's actually taken time to listen to my music. I was blown away by that. But fast forward 2007, you're talking a good 8 years later, I was asked by Prince, but via AEG, the promoters who were putting him on at the O2, for a record-breaking 21 nights at the O2, I was asked by them if I would open for Prince. Well, you can imagine how that felt.
I mean, a lifetime highlight?
Absolutely. So I did, but it got better than that, because after I did my first performance opening for him, I got off stage, the band got off stage, his band kind of gave me a lovely round of applause as we came off. And right at the end of the line was Prince. And he asked me, now this is the first time I'm having a proper conversation with him. He asked me if I would join him on stage at his after show party, which was at the Indigo Club, just round the corner from the O2 in the same building, which of course I did. And I joined him a further 4 times. It
was
incredible. Absolutely amazing. Amazing. And then he flew me to Los Angeles to repeat the experience at his post-Oscars party with Stevie Wonder. And the great and good of Hollywood was there. Just, there are no words to explain how that felt to me as a Prince obsessive.
And this is the chapter where you learned the most about yourself. What did you learn from him as a performer? Being part of these, of that larger production, not when you were listening to him growing up, but actually then having that connection with him, what did you learn then?
The greatest thing you can be when you're on stage with these people, or if you get an opportunity to become, you know, a global icon, is humility and having the grace to be able to share that experience with other people coming up. Prince didn't need to do any of those things. You know, Bowie and Carlos Santana and all these other people who have been so kind to me over the course of my career. They didn't have to share space with me on a stage. They didn't have to champion me. But when you get to the top, you pay it forward. You absolutely get behind those people who were coming up. The way that they got behind me, that was a huge thing for me. You know, bring people with you, welcome them in, and allow them, you know, yes, the spotlight's on you, but just get that spotlight, turn it a little bit, focus some light on these people who are coming up behind you. You know,
and the same can't be said for all megastars. So those are special ones who do that.
Absolutely correct. And I've never forgotten that. Mm. I mean, he taught me other things about the industry itself, the importance of, you know, staying in control of one's own creative experience and owning your own music, you know, owning your masters, you know, if you're in a position to do so, all the things which are perhaps more specific to the music industry. But in terms of just a life lesson, it being encouraging of those who are coming behind you and sharing space with them, at that, I will never forget that generosity towards me. Never, ever, ever will I forget it.
Oh. Well, chapter four, Beverly, that is, this is the hard one for everyone because it's the all-time favorite destination. Which is the place that comes to mind for that?
I thought about this a lot. And I'm torn because I've been to Jamaica twice. It's the land of my heritage. Stepping on the soil, I had tears in my eyes straight away. A place that I wasn't born there. I wasn't raised there. I know so much about it. I have parents who born, raised, all everything, came to Britain. But getting on that plane and going to Jamaica and seeing that place for the first time, I felt like there was a side of me that I didn't quite get and understand as a child growing up, even though I was born in Britain, raised in Britain, all the rest of it. The summit missing, that missing bit was found when I got to Jamaica.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And so that place will always, always, always be magic for
me. A part of you.
It always will be. A place that I, like I said, I wasn't raised there. I wasn't born there. But there's so much of me that is there because it's my background. It's my heritage. Mm. We had maps of Jamaica as kids and my parents would go all the way west and then a little bit south and say, and that's where we're from, you know, St. Elizabeth, Donegal and Springfield in the parish of St. Elizabeth, Jamaica. And when I actually went there and visited my great aunt for the first time and saw her and cousins and just saw the land and then saw the church where my father and my mother were both baptized, that my dad had strong ties to right up until his passing, and then saw the school that both my mum and dad went to.
They went so they grew up together, your parents?
Absolutely. Same area, same district, went to the same school, Springfield All Age Church in St. Elizabeth Parish. There was so much about it that just made me think, oh my God, my life makes sense. I get it. I absolutely get it. But then I have to, in saying all of that, and this really is going to sound cheesy and cliched, but I have to big up London at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And again, a place that I was not born in, I wasn't raised in London, I didn't go to school in London. I now live in London, but memories of coming here every year, because I had, again, massive family, aunts, uncles, cousins who I'm very close to, who lived in London and seeing this place, which for me as a history nerd, massive history nerd, this place which was history come to life for me. I love London so much. I love going to Spitalfields. I love seeing Victorian Britain right there in front of my eyes in the modern day, you know? Artillery Row, Folgate Street with the Georgian houses. Do you go to Shad Thames, for example, you know, right near the Tower Bridge?
Yeah.
Make sure you look up. You're going to see those. They look like beams from connecting one building to another. And I remember asking, you know, what that was about. And then went on Google to actually, you know, kind of flesh it out a bit more and found out that was how people got barrels of, you know, whether it be sugar or whatever, rum or whatever it was, whatever goods, they got them from one warehouse to another by rolling them because these things were slanted.
Really?
So you could roll them.
Oh, how interesting.
Amazing. Before the days of having lifts and things and pulleys and, you know, what we would do now. And just incredible stuff. I mean, I cannot tell you how much I love London and how beautiful and special London will always be to me. So
you have two all-time faves and that is absolutely fine with me.
great. That's all right then.
And you know, you're spending so much of your life traveling as a musician, touring, yes, seeing different parts of the world.
Yeah.
Chapter 5 is your hidden gem, which is a place that you love that maybe my listeners wouldn't know so much about. It could be a little cafe, it could be a city, but somewhere that is, you think, maybe a bit undiscovered. Where comes to mind for you for that today?
Now, it's known as a place where lots of rich and famous people live and go. And yes, there are lots of rich and famous people who live there, but there's also regular people who live there doing regular things. But if you have the chance to fly to Nassau and then get a little plane from Nassau to Harbour Island.
In the Bahamas.
It's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. Pink sands. It's tiny. You have golf buggies to get round. All those, you know, those beach buggy kind of.
Yeah.
That's how people...
That's how small it is as well, therefore.
It's tiny.
Yeah.
You walk it easily. It's just so gorgeous. And there's parts of it that's still so kind of raw and charming. It's amazing. It's a beautiful, beautiful little place.
I should say, listeners, if you are inspired by Beverly chatting about Harbour Island, go a few seasons back and you'll find my beautiful Bahamas special with India Hicks,
yes,
who lives on Harbour Island. And she brings the island also to life beautifully and gives lots more recommendations. So don't forget to go and have a listen to that as well.
Absolutely. Yes, of course. India Hicks lives there. Dave Stewart lives there. Lots of fun folk. And they're just living their lives quietly, you know.
Yeah, it's low-key.
Very low-key, and that's what I liked about it.
Quite rootsy.
Very rootsy and very proud of its, you know, Caribbean heritage, you know. They celebrate John Canoe there, which is a festival, and they parade through the streets, you know, kind of around Christmas time. It's so rootsy, and so it's not just all, oh my God, it's so fabulous. It's not at all. It's an earthy place where the history from the Caribbean and then going right back to Africa is celebrated and is so important. And everybody who goes there is expected to kind of adhere to that low-key, chilled way of living. And I love that. It's really, really great.
Yeah, oh, sounds incredible. It in contrast to that, then, from the sublime to the ridiculous, Chapter 6 is your worst travel experience or the place that you'd never go back to? What have you had a shocker of a travel experience along the way?
Sadly, I've had a few shockers.
When you travel so much, it's not surprising, yeah, really.
I've had several shockers, but a place which lots of people go to and that I'm going to have to give another go, but man, I don't know. And this might surprise a few people. Chicago.
Really interesting. Yeah. So what was it that didn't connect with you?
Arriving there at Chicago O'Hare, worst airport ever that I've ever been to. If something's going to go wrong, it's going to go wrong at O'Hare. If you're going to get a cancelled flight, I mean, that happens a lot, but the ensuing fallout, mismanagement and all the rest of it, it's going to happen in O'Hare. You know, I've...
Word of warning.
I've honestly... And the problem is O'Hare is a hub.
It's a big connecting airport, isn't it?
It's a big hub. Mm. So often you've got to fly to O'Hare to get to somewhere else. Mm. I will do everything in my power to avoid flying to O'Hare because I'm going to lose luggage, which has happened to me in O'Hare. I'm going to miss a connecting flight because the queue for just getting through the security is crazy long and not enough desks are open, which has happened to me in O'Hare. Everything that can go wrong with travel has gone wrong in O'Hare. So I do everything to avoid it. But the one time that I actually went into Chicago and just hung around, I was so looking forward to it. House of Blues, you know, Al Capone and all the things that you hear about it. All I got were pretty, I'll be honest, miserable people who were so wrapped up in their own everyday lives. Fair enough. But I found them quite hostile and quite rude.
And it's the people that make a place.
And it's the people that make a place, absolutely. The amount of times I would walk into a shop, I remember going there, I went there with my manager, went into a shop, coffee shop, and that old adage of the people, two people who are serving or meant to be serving, having a conversation, and I'm standing there, they're having a conversation, I'm standing there having their conversation, and I'm like, oh, excuse me, what do you want? Excuse me, I've just come here to be served. Sorry. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
You know, I've had people who haven't understood me, so they've quite rudely asked me, you know, to say something again and then asked me if I spoke English.
What? No, that's not cool.
I mean, I'm describing the people. You know, I know Chicago has loads of great things about it. I know that. But when you have a bad experience with humans, it really does put you off of a place.
Totally, it does, yeah. And somebody else really could have a completely different and positive experience with the people. I mean, I'm sure that they do because, in fact, Chicago is often one of the most popular cities picked.
That's right.
It's your personal human interactions. They can completely put you off a place.
It really did because I even said to my manager at the time, is it me or is everybody here just not being very pleasant?
They do have a long, harsh winter, don't they, as well?
They do.
It is cold and it is windy.
Yes. Maybe I'll go back and have a whole new experience, but from airport to human interaction actually in the city, I was not a fan. I really didn't like it. I just found there was a hostility that was palpable and it really did put me off. But I'd be happy to hear other people's fabulous experiences of Chicago. And yeah, maybe it'll help me to change my mind.
Oh, Beverly, it's been so, I mean, I feel like we could chat for hours about your incredible travels, and it has been so lovely to chat today.
Thank you.
We're now at the final chapter, chapter 7, and that is the destination that is at the top of your travel bucket list.
The one area of the world that I haven't had a chance to spend a lot of time in is the Far East. And I've been to Thailand, but that was once, and I thought it was incredible and I loved it. But as someone who, I mean, typically, you know, I talk about food all the time, but as someone who loves the food, you know, I love my Thai food, I love my Japanese food, I want to explore the Far East much more. From a music point of view, I really want to play the Budokan in Japan. I really, really want to see the Great Wall of China. I've so would love to go and do that. People talk about Cambodia and Vietnam as being utterly beautiful. The age I am, when I think of Cambodia and I think of Vietnam, my mind instantly makes the association with war, which is not fair and not right. But, you know, that's, I can, when I was born, Vietnam was still happening. It was coming to a close, but, you know, it was still happening. And I remember, you know, the war in Cambodia and that. And so I want to go back and dispel that from my mind entirely. Mm. Because everybody I know who has ever been tells me it's beautiful. And I have lots of Vietnamese friends who tell me, Bev, you've got to go. It's the most incredible country. You would love it. You'd love the food. You'd love the experience. I want to go and see, you know, Singapore and Malaysia. You know, these are, I have, again, great friends who are from there.
I feel a tour coming on, no?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I think you need to make it happen.
That is what I want to do. I'd love to tour that part of the world, you know, go to these special countries, Indonesia and all those countries, and perform, but not only perform, because performance often you turn up, you just see the building, the stage,
and then on to the next,
and then you're off. Yeah. I'd want to go and spend time in these places and experience just a little bit of what it feels like to, you know, live your life there, somewhere which is so far away from my own experiences of life.
Well, I have absolutely no doubt that you will get there.
Yeah.
You will, because you have that energy that will make it happen.
It is my dream, and I will. I absolutely will make that work one day. One day soon.
I hope so. Oh, thank you so much, Beverly Knight. Those were your... Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. And what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb super host. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom, and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Glorious travel diaries. It has been such a pleasure.
Thank you so much. There's so many more places that I've been to in the world. But if I could say anything, is we live in a beautiful, beautiful world. And there are some beautiful places to discover. So when you get the opportunity to travel, take it. Take it. And see things that you haven't seen before through the eyes of people you've never met before. Mm,
beautiful words to end on. Thank you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Oh, what a lovely lady. I loved travelling the world with Beverly, and her voice is something else. If you would like to hear more from Beverly, her album The Fifth Chapter is out now, and she's currently touring the UK. Thanks so much for listening today. If you'd like to hear more from the podcast, don't forget to hit subscribe, or if you use Apple Podcasts, to press follow so that a new episode lands in your podcast app each week. If you want to be the first to find out who is joining me on next week's episode, come and follow me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein, and you'll also find me on Threads and TikTok. I'd love to hear from you. And if you can't wait until next week, remember, there's the first 9 seasons to catch up on. That's over 100 episodes to keep you busy there. Don't forget that all the destinations mentioned by my guests are included in the episode show notes here on your podcast app and listed on my website, thetraveldiariespodcast.com. Thanks again, everyone. Take care, and I'll be back next week.